crazy cooties out there, and I'm an assistant professor in medicine at the University of British Columbia. But in my spare time, I've done science communication for many years. So a lot of science documentary television work. I've worked with The Nature of Things since 2007. Hosting the odd episode here and there, getting to take over from David Suzuki now and then. And I also do a bit of work for Daily Planet on the Discovery Channel, and I've done some science writing for the Globe and Mail. So really, I'm a scientist, but a scientist who's really excited by talking about science and really sharing my passion and enthusiasm for the field with as many people as possible, really just trying to point out the cool science in our everyday lives.
Well, how did you get into science?
How did I get into science?
I mean, what led you down the path? You know, why didn't you become a doctor, for instance, or an educator?
Question. I think it's really natural curiosity. One of the things that characterizes scientists everywhere, no matter whether you're, say, an astronomer, a biologist, a chemist, a physicist, it's this incredible driving curiosity. It's the need to know, to understand why things happen, how things work, what's the explanation for this. And there's no greater thrill than discovering something and recognizing that you are the first person to have ever learned this thing or observed this phenomenon or found an explanation for that. I think it's one of the last kind of frontiers of discovery and exploration left in our world is science. It's really your chance to find something totally new. So I was always really interested in science as a kid. I also really liked languages as a kid, too. So that's probably why I ended up sort of in this career that combines a little bit of the science with a little bit of the science communication. But you get to do a lot of cool stuff. I'm really grateful for the career that I have.
Dr. Gardy, who influenced you to become a scientist? Was there any one individual or any individuals that you could tell us about who guided you in this path, or were influential?
One of my favorite scientists, it's obviously somebody I never got a chance to meet because they lived hundreds of years before me, but Louis Pasteur, the great French microbiologist who's really responsible for discovering germ theory and the notion that all these small pathogens, be they bacteria, viruses, fungi, parasites, are what cause disease. And I remember as a kid growing up, I had this wonderful series of books about famous scientists. And these were geared to sort of your 8 to 10-year-old readers. And they talked about everybody from Marie Curie to Einstein. But my favorite book, the one that I would drag off the shelf time and time again, was Louis Pasteur. I just thought the idea of observing this teeny tiny invisible world that had, you know, such power for death and destruction, but so fascinating. I loved, loved, loved his story. So I think that really kind of set me on the course for what I do in my scientific career, which is microbiology and understanding pathogenesis, how infectious diseases work.
Well, we know that was microbes that won the War of the Worlds, if you remember. It was disease that brought down those aliens, right?
So yeah. Again, tiny and deadly.
Exactly, tiny and deadly. Well, we're going to talk about the myths now, because several of the things that you talk about in your show, is the 5-second rule okay? I got to ask you this, though. Is the 5-second rule still true?
You know, it really depends on the food that you're dropping and the surface that you're dropping it onto. Because that's the thing. I mean, you know, no two foods are alike. No two surfaces are alike. So the way I like to explain the 5-second rule is, imagine if you had some sand and you sprinkled it onto two surfaces. You sprinkled it onto some tile, and then you sprinkled it onto some good old 1970s style shag rug.
Right.
And then you walked over both of those surfaces in your bare feet. Would you get more sand sticking to your feet if you walked over the tile or if you walked over the shag carpet?
Well, what I would think over the tile.
Exactly, over the tile. So what you've got there is a surface where, you know, maybe the same amount of microbes or sand grains, whatever you're thinking of, the same amount is present on that surface. But with the shag example, it's kind of hidden from the surface. It's buried deep beneath these little fibers. So the same thing kind of happens with the 5-second rule. You know, the amount of dirt, and perhaps there are microbes in that dirt, the amount that gets transferred from the floor to your food slice, be it, you know, pizza, cheese, peanut butter, or whatever, is going to depend on the floor that you drop it on, but it's also going to depend on what you drop on it, too. So if you drop, for example, say, like a really dry, saltine cracker Or you drop, you know, a freshly buttered piece of bread buttered side down.
Always falls the butter side down, too, by
the way. It always does, I know. And it picks up all the stuff, which in my house, you know, I wouldn't be afraid to eat off the floor in my house. Microbe-wise, you just got a mouthful of dog hair, probably.
Right. That's hilarious. Well, I watched a little bit of the video that was sent to us about the brain freeze. And for the listeners out there that didn't hear that yesterday, can you walk them through a little bit about how that brain freeze works?
Well, that was a fun one that we did in our very first Myth or Science episode, mm-hmm. You know, and we wanted to get at the science behind what causes brain freeze. So that was kind of a fun one. We loaded a bunch of kids into a large refrigerated semi-trailer. You don't get to do that often on television. Fed them a bunch of ice cream and looked at how long it took them to get brain freeze and whether the outside temperature had anything to do with it. Because some people think that, oh, when it's cold outside, you'll get brain freeze quicker. But really what it boils down to is just that sort of shock, that stimulation to the trigeminal nerve that sends a little signal up to your brain going, oh.
No, exactly. And of course, pain, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It didn't take long either, I noticed. It was in, what, just a few seconds, really?
Just a few seconds. That's the interesting thing about, you know, nerves and impulses and stuff. These things, our bodies are so fantastically interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, these signals can travel like a pain signal. You know, you get a paper cut and right away, ow. I mean, just the speed with which signals move throughout our body. We did a really interesting story on Myth or Science 2, which aired last season. It's frequently on in repeats in CBC, so you can still catch it, and you can catch it online. We looked at whether exercising helps to reverse the aging process or some of the outward signs of the aging process.
Right.
And we found a really neat story about the body there, too, which is even fairly gentle forms of exercise, you know, doing a little bit of stationary bike riding a few times a week, doing a little bit of weight training, actually cause the release of molecules. The researcher that we talked to, he nicknames them exerkines, little tiny small molecules that are produced by your body as a positive response to exercise. And these things seem to sort of course rapidly throughout your system. And over the course of a few weeks or a few months doing these exercise programs actually result in really interesting molecular changes. So we looked at some stuff in human skin. Does the molecular structure of skin change in response to exercise over time? And sure enough, it does. You can sort of get at the fountain of youth, but it requires getting on an exercise bike and putting in a little bit of effort.
Really? Okay. Well, that's obviously good news for folks who like to work out, especially, I mean, I knew a gentleman here who lives here in Coburg, actually, and he was a world champion bodybuilder in his late 70s.
Yeah, you know, the age is nothing but a number. It's all about, you know, how you treat your body, what you do. And we know, you know, the science shows again and again, and we see this in every Myth or Science episode. The science says, you know, eat a healthy, balanced diet that is comprised of real foods, not processed foods. Get activity. It doesn't have to be, you know, strenuous exercise. You don't need to be, you know, weightlifting like a champ. You don't need to be running ultra marathons. You just need to get moving. And those two simple things are a surprisingly good prescription for a happy, healthy life.
Well, I just let the listeners know you're listening to Northumberland 89.7. This is The Drive Time. Joining me is Dr. Jennifer Gardy, the intrepid scientist. She is the host, if you will, of The Nature of Things, Myth or Science. This is part three, isn't it, Jennifer?
This is part three. And we've got four and five coming up next season.
Really? Wow. So you've already got two more in the can.
Yeah, they seem to like us.
That's awesome. So that airs tomorrow on CBC Nature of Things at 8 p.m. That's Thursday, January 8th. Rob Washburn, by the way, is my guest here this afternoon, Jennifer. He's got a question for you.
One of the sections that I really enjoyed was the one on the beer goggles. And I was wondering if you could tell the listeners about that exercise that you did.
Oh, I love that story. That story is one of my favorites for a couple different reasons. You know, first of all, the production process for Myth or Science, it takes a while to make these episodes because there's a ton of research that goes into it. We have an amazing researcher, Monica Delmos. She really gets into the nitty-gritty of these things. And we have all these production meetings and lists of myths and possible ideas for the show are being passed around. And I saw one of the short lists and said, you know what this list needs? Beer goggles. Let's look at the science of beer goggles. Because there'd been a couple interesting studies over the last year that had popped up on my radar just in the course of my science work. And I said, this would really be fun to take a look at, and it's a perfect fit for the episode. So I was happy to see a story that I suggested make it to the big screen, and I got to recruit a couple of my girlfriends in Vancouver to be our experimental subjects. So what we did is, there's a lot of conflicting information around beer goggles and a lot of potential explanations for it. So, you know, maybe people become more attractive after a few drinks because our inhibitions are lower, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the interesting scientific studies that came out last year around the beer goggles phenomenon looked at something very different. They looked at the idea of facial asymmetry. So people have said for years and years and years that one of the hallmarks of an attractive face is being perfectly or near perfectly symmetrical. You see it in Hollywood celebrities. Mm-hmm. You see it in models. Basically, everything's arranged neatly and orderly on somebody's face. And the idea with beer goggles, some researchers thought, okay, we know that people's ability to perceive, you know, shapes and perspective and things is blunted a little bit by alcohol. Maybe one of the explanations for beer goggles could be that as people drink, their ability to detect asymmetry, this cue that says, hey, this person is not as attractive as that more symmetrical person over there, their ability to detect this asymmetry becomes blunted. So a face that when they were sober might register as, say, you know, a 6 out of 10 because they're picking up on, oh, their left eye is a little higher than the right and, you know, their nose is a little goofy on one side. All of a sudden, after a couple of pints, that ability disappears and that 6 out of 10 maybe moves up to, say, an 8 out of 10. A really interesting and very fun science, and I think one that almost anybody can relate to.
Well, that's another reason why people can't obviously trust what they see.
Oh, yeah.
Because after a few, maybe, you know, you're not seeing as well as you could have. Or,
exactly.
You know, although the inhibitions thing may be another angle that that could be true, too. You get a few beers.
Yeah. There have been some really interesting studies around that, too. And the idea that people also find themselves more attractive after they've been drinking, too, and find themselves wittier and funnier. A really neat study, too, actually showed that that effect occurs even when people think they've been drinking, that have actually been drinking placebo drinks. So
really?
They've been given, say, de-alcoholized beer or, you know, a gin and tonic that is not a gin and tonic. It's just something that tastes like one. People, after a couple drinks, just feel like they're, you know, more confident and funnier. It's a very interesting science there.
That is interesting.
I was really interested, too, with the blood type diet that you did a piece on this particular diet. I was wondering if you could explain to the listeners what this diet is and what you found.
Yeah, this is one they may have heard about. It was a diet that was put forth in a book called Eat Right for Your Blood Type by, I believe it was a naturopath in the States, Peter D'Adamo, I think is his name. And this book was huge. You know, it was on the New York Times bestseller list. It sold millions of copies. And the premise, which really does sort of strike people as a bit odd, I think, when you hear it, yet people are buying the book. The premise is no accounting for some people's taste when it comes to diets. You know, people are always looking for a quick fix. But D'Adamo's premise was that blood types, you know, O, A, B, A, B, they evolved at different times in human history. So depending on the blood type that you have, you should be eating foods that correspond to what our ancestors were eating in that phase of our evolution. So myself, for example, I have the O blood type, and D'Adamo says this is the oldest blood type, and our ancestors that would have all had type O blood were, you know, out there hunting woolly mammoths and eating a lot of meat. So people with O type diets, according to his book, are supposed to eat a mostly meat-based diet. Whereas, you know, AB, for example, or A or B, the more recent blood types, that sort of corresponds with humans' agricultural era and, you know, growing crops, for example. So they need to have a more plant-based diet. So how we looked at this one was a little bit of self-experimentation. We always do a lot of experiments on me in Myth or Science, which
That's
is fun.
Always nice. You get to be the guinea pig.
Exactly. You know, it's gotten easier over the years. They've given me simpler and simpler tasks to do. And this one was a pretty straightforward task. I had to eat the opposite diet than the book recommended for me. So, you know, if there's any truth to this hypothesis that you can eat right for your blood type and that eating the wrong foods would be somehow harmful, that if I ate the wrong diet for my blood type, the exact opposite, after a few months on that diet, I should show some sort of negative effect. Mm-hmm. So for several months, I ate just a vegetarian diet, which is really easy to do when you're in Vancouver. And I took a whole bunch of blood markers before and after the diet phase. So went in, got all my blood work done, had pretty good baseline levels going into it. I eat a pretty healthy diet already. But after 2 months, we had to look at those markers, and I'm going to bust this one for your listeners. They don't have to stay tuned for this one. They can stay tuned for the rest of the show, but this one I'm going to bust because I think it's an important one. What was interesting is we showed that there's really no substance to the blood type diet whatsoever. And even though I was eating exactly the opposite of the diet that the book prescribed to me, mm-hmm. my markers across the board improved. And it's because I was eating a mostly plant-based diet, you know, eating real foods, mostly plants is what's being recommended. So if there were any truth to this blood type diet myth, I should have shown some sort of, you know, negative reaction. Some of the markers would have maybe stayed the same, gone down, but instead it was just positive change across the board. And we looked at, you know, 15, 20 different markers. Every single one mm-hmm. was better. So it just goes to show that, you know, when it comes to diets, there's no such thing as a quick fix. There's no real sense to fad diets. I mean, it really boils down to eating real food, eating a lot of plant-based food, avoiding processed food, mm-hmm. and everything in moderation.
That's one of the things that I found really interesting about your approach to this program is that you're looking to help us better understand science and what's valid and what's not. And I just wondered, how did you come up with this as a concept and as an approach? Because, you know, we are faced almost on a regular basis, all kinds of books and eat this and don't eat that and mm-hmm. bacon's good for you and no it's not and don't drink coffee and you should drink coffee and all these kinds of things, and it gets very difficult, I guess, for everyday people to sort of sift through this. So maybe could you talk a bit about your approach to science and to busting these kinds of myths?
That's really, you know, you hit the nail on the head. We wanted to make a program that answers people's questions.
Right.
We know that, you know, when you go online, when you open the newspaper, you know, when you're watching the evening news, you'll see all these conflicting headlines out there, conflicting websites, you know, this is good for you. No, wait, this is bad for you. No, wait, this is good for you, but only on a Tuesday when it's a full moon. So people have a difficult time making sense of health and medical information that's out there on the internet. So with the Myth or Science show, we really try and get at what are some of the questions that people are asking, what are some of the hot, you know, water cooler topics, and let's take a real look at the science behind them. So it was really born out of a desire to answer people's questions, but also do it in a way that really shows everybody that there's a surprising amount of science behind everything we do, you know, be it the meals that we're eating, the exercise regime that we're on, the beer that we're drinking, how we work on, you know, our memory or our brains or our willpower. There's science behind everything. And very often, science can provide those answers.
Do you ever look at where the origins of some of these myths or folk tales or, you know, folk wisdom comes from, or how it starts? Like, you know, one of the ones that you do is, you know, brown eggs are healthier than white eggs.
And, yeah.
You know, I mean, my grandmother would have told you that. So do you ever look at the origins of some of these myths?
We do occasionally. I know that for our research team, it can be pretty tricky to actually find, you know, where these ideas come from, mm-hmm. because all these things that become popular wisdom, very often you can never go back and find an original source for it. And in fact, in the medical communities, there was a bit of a stink this week when there was a very famous medical quote that somebody had gone back and researched and said, hey, this person never said this thing that we've been attributing to them for the past, you know, 150 years that we've all been saying time and time again. And really, that's what we see when we look at all of these, you know, these claims, like, for example, you need to drink 8 glasses of water a day to stay hydrated, which is one that we're looking at in tomorrow's episode.
Mm-hmm.
These things just kind of get passed down as wisdom from generation to generation, or repeated just because they've become so embedded in pop culture. we just have no idea where they came from in the first place. So occasionally we do find a good origin story. In the very first myth or science, we looked at the claim that people lose most of their body heat through their head and found that the origins of that were actually in a scientific study. It was done by the U.S. military for an entirely different purpose. They were basically testing out these cold weather survival suits, and they were putting people in these suits, you know, out on an ice floe or something in the Arctic, mm-hmm. and they said, hey, they lost all their body heat through their head, but that's because they weren't wearing hats. This was an entirely unscientific conclusion drawn from a study that really wasn't meant to answer that question. Yet, this one little piece of folklore, you know, wear a hat because you lose all your body heat through your head, has been passed on from generation to generation.
Mm-hmm. So are we saying that's not true then?
That is not true. You lose body heat pretty much equally across your body, depending on what is covered or not. So, you know, you could go out with the best hat in the world on and a coat, but no pants. You're going to lose body heat through your tushy and your feet. So that's a false one.
Well, it looks like we got a caller, Jen. I think we'll take that caller, if you don't mind. Northumberland. Northumberland 89.7, you are on the air.
Yes, I'm going to kill my radio. Thank you. Okay, so I got a couple of things to say. While you're on the heat loss out of your head.
Oops.
Oh, my gosh. Hang on a minute. There we go. How's that? Is that better now?
Hopefully.
If it's not, then it's not me. Okay, okay, so the brain has more blood flowing to it than most parts of the body. Yes?
Ooh. There are certain parts of your body that have a lot of blood flowing through them. I'd say probably your highest volume, I'm not a physiologist, so don't quote me on this, but I suspect your highest volume is actually in what are called your arteriovenous anastomoses. And those are, they're kind of like your body's radiators. They're found on the soles of your feet, palms of your hands, in your cheeks. And essentially that's where basically big arteries will spread out into a whole bunch of little small tubes and then coalesce together in a vein, and they act as kind of heat sinks. So if, for example, it's a really hot day, your AVAs, as we call them for short, as blood passes through those, it's being exposed to sort of a larger surface, a vessel surface area, and that actually helps heat transfer. So it's a way that you can cool down.
Yes, like a radiator.
Yeah, exactly, like a radiator.
Precisely. Also places where you would be more inclined to be touching things and losing heat in the first place.
Yeah, so, you know, if it's a really hot day, we looked at this in, we did this in CBC years ago for a show I worked with called Project X, and found that if you're overheating, you know, really hot day, one of the easiest ways to cool yourself down, if you've not got access to, say, an air conditioner or a fan, is to put your palms and the soles of your feet, where these AVAs are located, into a little pool of cold water.
Yep, I used to do that all the time, put my forearms in the sink at work when I was too hot.
Works like a charm.
Absolutely amazing. Okay, the other thing I wanted to say something about was the beer goggle effect.
Yeah.
What if, rather than, it's not me. That was not me. My radios are off. What if when people who have had a couple of beers, whether it's the person who is being looked at or doing the looking, is no longer actually only looking at the exterior of the person, but actually seeing what, like, the actual person themselves is, rather than what they look like on the outside?
It's a good point. Yeah, you know, as people's inhibitions are lowered due to alcohol, maybe people's true personality bubbles to the surface. You know, that person mm-hmm. that might have seemed charming a couple hours ago, all mm-hmm. of a sudden maybe turns into the angry drunk. So that's the thing with beer goggles. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting explanations and a lot of potential science behind it. But, you know, we could probably make a whole hour just about beer goggles alone. But we only had about 10 minutes to tell the story. So as with many things in science television, you kind of have to pick which thread you're going to go with and run with that one. So in our case, it was going with the symmetry, because that's probably where the best science is so far. We're always looking for what's the best evidence, the best studies that are out there. And that mm-hmm. was the one we chose.
Right. So maybe a possible study topic.
This could be the sequel.
A whole other show.
Myth or Science 14.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Deb. Thanks for your call.
You're welcome. See ya.
See you now. Well, there you go. A couple of interesting questions there.
Yeah, very.
Now, is sea salt better for you than table salt? That's something else you're going to be looking at on the documentary at all. We don't want to, of course, bust all the myths for the listeners out there.
We're not going to bust all. Everybody's got to stay tuned tomorrow.
Exactly. But again, so just a lot of various things. And I mean, it's got to take you quite a long time. I'm sure your researchers are just run off their feet trying to figure out, well, first of all, they got to come up with the ideas, and then they've got to research them out. How long does it usually take to put a show like this together?
It takes a surprising amount of time and a lot of people. It's one thing, you know, when you meet these scientists in the field, maybe folks that haven't worked with the television crew before, and you tell them how long you're going to need to work with them, they're always like, wow, that long? I thought TV was faster. But it's a pretty long process. We usually start the research probably a good sort of 8 to 12 months ahead of the production process. So that's where we start brainstorming some of the ideas that we might look at, coming up with some short lists of myths, really digging into what some of the science out there, and really importantly, who are the scientists that are doing this work, and who's somebody that we can visit, that somebody that's accessible, has an interesting lab, is willing to work with us and help us set up some experiments. So it's partially looking at the science and the story, and partially looking at the characters. Once we've got our list of things together, the script is being written, we know what sort of shots we need to go out and collect. We typically spend in total about 3 weeks out in the field doing all the shooting, usually for the big stories that you see in the show. So in this episode, looking at whether sugar makes kids hyper, do you need 8 glasses of water a day, the beer goggles, the 5-second rule, and another really interesting study where we look at the effect of caffeine on memory. Those sorts of things will typically be out in the field with the scientist, usually for about 2 to 3 days. And then, you know, you're traveling between different places. We visit a couple different cities across North America to do this. So I'd say in total, from, you know, first inkling of an idea to finished product, you're generally looking at upwards of a year.
Wow, that's a lot of time. Do you ever get a scientist when you contact them and say, no, I really don't want to be on camera? Did anyone tell you no, they don't want to get involved?
Nobody's ever told me no, but they may have told the researcher. That doesn't trickle down to me, so I'm on the need-to-know basis.
Right, It's above your pay grade, I guess.
Everybody seems to like working with us so far. I guess maybe we filter out the duds up at the beginning, but every scientist we've ended up working with has just been fantastic. And usually they're people whose research is making the headlines, so they're used to working with media crews, and you know they've got the routine down pat, and they're excited to do it. They're excited to share their research and their findings with the community, and we always have a good time.
One of the things that your Myth or Science program does is talk about popular things, but I know that you're also a very serious scientist, and could you take a moment just to describe what it is you look at and what you study in the university environment?
Sure. Hardly anybody ever lets me talk about this on the radio. This is fantastic.
Well, this is why we got you on the show here. That's right, to talk about you.
I love it. So what I do, I work in the field of public health and understanding, you know, what makes populations sick. And in particular, you know, inspired, like I said a while ago, by Louis Pasteur when I was small, I study bacteria, I study viruses, I study communicable and infectious diseases. And in particular, my interest is how we can use really new cutting-edge biology techniques, you know, things like some of the DNA analysis that you might see on a show like CSI, for example, to track the spread of infectious disease and figure out how disease is transmitting from person to person. And more importantly, once we have that information, can we use it to design really effective public health interventions to stop disease from transmitting? So it's really interesting. You know, it's fascinating stuff. There's always infectious disease going around, so there's always something to study, and you can see your work making a real difference. So I love it.
Well, especially in a world now, I mean, we've had the Ebola outbreak, which thankfully hasn't, you know, translated into a global outbreak as yet. But can we talk a little bit about that? I mean,
yeah.
It's usually Center for Disease Control kind of stuff, but this is really something in your wheelhouse, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, Ebola is an interesting disease. A lot of people, when they're asked to, you know, rank diseases, infectious diseases from, you know, scariest to least scary, Ebola is certainly on the top of the list. And the interesting thing about Ebola is that while the virus itself is certainly, you know, quite harmful and potentially very dangerous, what is a larger contributor to risk isn't the virus, it's the population, the vulnerability of the population that that virus is spreading in. Because with Ebola, we can kill it with soap. We can kill it with a 1 in 10 bleach dilution. We can prevent it from being transmitted from person to person if people don't have contact with bodily fluids of somebody who is infected and symptomatic. We know how to stop this virus. But in West Africa, where the outbreak is happening right now, it's a problem of resources. There aren't enough medical facilities to treat Ebola patients adequately. People are not informed about how the virus spreads, so they might have an ill family member and they're treating them with no sort of protective equipment, no gloves, no mask, no gown. So Ebola is a great example of something that is definitely a hazard. It's a dangerous virus, but it's one that if you are a well-resourced healthcare setting, you know, like North America, like we have here in Canada, a case of Ebola will not really transmit onwards. You know, one person might import it. They might be, you know, working in West Africa or traveling there, bring a case back here. They're going to be recognized right away. They're going to be put into the appropriate quarantine facilities. The healthcare workers that are working with them have been trained in how to use the appropriate, what we call PPE, personal protective equipment. So you've got really, you're taking away that virus's chance to spread. So it's really, in the case of Ebola, a question of resources as opposed to an actual dangerous virus.
Are there, I mean, I'm probably spitballing here, but are there viruses out there that you think we should be worried about perhaps more than something like Ebola?
Absolutely. And, you know, what we're seeing right now is a really, really bad influenza season.
Right.
People fail to recognize influenza for the threat that it is, I think. They sort of treat it like, oh, whatever, it's just the flu. But the reality is that every year the flu does kill thousands of Canadians. And these are usually our most vulnerable Canadians, too, the very young or the very old, or people that have some sort of what we call comorbidity. Maybe they're undergoing cancer treatment or they have asthma or COPD or some sort of other respiratory condition. So thousands of deaths every year that are largely preventable. The flu shot does do a fairly good job of protecting against the virus. It's never perfect. Some years are more perfect than others. This year is not the best year. But even so, I mean, hand hygiene, practicing good hand washing, making sure during the winter season you're not touching your face. You know, a virus has to get into your nose or mouth or throat for it to establish infection and cause disease. So, you know, if you're, say, touching a sick person or you've maybe, you know, handled the photocopier at work and the office sickie has just coughed all over it, you're in no danger as long as you go and wash your hands right away.
Right. So really, personal hygiene is obviously a big factor there, right?
It's huge. I mean, we saw with the 2009 swine flu, the H1N1 outbreak, was that it was a while. It wasn't really until October for an outbreak that started in April that we actually had a vaccine that we were able to distribute. So in the meantime, your only defense against the swine flu was hand hygiene and just, you know, practicing cough etiquette, not touching your face, all of those things. And what we found was that it was surprisingly effective. And in fact, all the other respiratory infections, your basic, you know, colds, rhinoviruses, coronaviruses, all of those things were down across the board too. People were just being more careful.
Absolutely. Well, that's often what it takes, right? A little more. Rob, you had a question?
Yeah, I did. How did you get into the role of being a science communicator? Could you tell us how you got your start?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, looking back to when I was small, I think I was always one of those people that was destined to do science and talk. Those were the two things that I loved to do the most when I was little. You know, I used to, for example, my parents would have dinner parties, and during the daytime, they'd be preparing like a nice whole salmon or something for the dinner party, and they'd give me the fish head, and I would go out and take it into the yard and play junior biologist and try and dissect it with a butter knife. Then I would come in when they were having their dinner party, and I used to, like a little ham, you know, recite the previous night Johnny Carson Tonight Show monologue, you know, to entertain the guests. So I always had this combination of, intrepid explorer / scientist and performing ham. So as I went through university, I studied science formally, but I always kept up the communication side of my interest and my personality. So I used to work at some of the campus newspapers as an undergraduate. I did some grad training at McGill in Montreal, and I worked in the Montreal Gazette's newsroom, so got a taste for what a real working newsroom was like.
Mm-hmm.
Came back to BC, and as I was doing my PhD, I decided to do a little bit of science communication, just as kind of a, freelance way to earn a bit of extra money on the side. So started doing some science writing for some of the local newspapers. That turned into a couple of science magazine gigs. And after a few years of doing all this science writing, I thought, well, writing about science is X amount of fun. Talking about it on television is probably 100X that amount of fun. So asked around in my little communications network, who was hiring for science television. Hey, if there's any opportunities that, cross your desk, let me know. And sure enough, one day somebody that I knew from science journalism and science writing had been approached by CBC. They were looking for some potential hosts for a new program that they were starting up, and got the audition notice forwarded to me by this friend. Applied for the show. Long story short, got that job. And the thing with science television is, once you get on it and you do a reasonably decent job, people just invite you back for more. Like, oh, okay, they're easy to work with. We'll hire them again. So, very so often the phone rings and somebody says, hey, I got a job for you.
One of the interesting things about science journalism, though, is there's not a lot of people that do it. What mm-hmm. makes good science journalism in your mind, and what makes poor science journalism?
That's a great question. I think what makes good science journalism is really connecting with your audience, using appropriate language. I just was complaining on Twitter the other day. There was this blog post debunking some of the statistics behind that study that just came out that said 2/3 of cancer are due to bad luck. So there was this blog post by two statisticians, basically sort of poking holes in the original argument. But I mm-hmm. found it was a terrible piece of science communication because they were so pompous in their tone and so inflated in their language that even I, as a PhD biologist and a professor in medicine at a major Canadian university, even I didn't really understand their blog post and had to read it a few times, let alone what the public, who they were ostensibly mm-hmm. writing this for. It was actually published as an online letter in The Guardian newspaper in the UK. I just found it a terrible example of science communication. It was overly complex and it was talking down mm-hmm. to the audience. So I think good science communication is done in a simple and relatable fashion. Good science communication answers questions that people want to know about. Good science communication puts a personal spin on things and makes things relevant to individuals, makes them say, oh, hey, I saw this really interesting thing on TV the other night. And I think I'm going to, change the way I, the color plates that I use, because that's one of the things that influences how much food I'm going to put on my plate.
Right.
To, expose people to science and get them talking about it. Mm-hmm. So fortunately, I think there's a lot of good science journalism out there. And one thing that I've noticed a lot is as universities are training more and more PhD students that have fewer and fewer open faculty slots, we have all these incredibly well-trained folks that are working in science and tech and engineering and math that are now finding alternative career paths. And I get asked, I probably get an email 2 or 3 times a week from mm-hmm. students saying, hey, I'm coming to the end of my PhD. I'm not going to do the traditional academic thing, but I'm really interested in science communication. Can I talk to you and get some ideas about what I could do in this field? So I think we're on the verge of a really interesting era in mm-hmm. science communication.
Absolutely,
we've got a lot of really cool, smart folks coming up. And with venues like the internet, where people are doing little science YouTube channels, running science blogs, science Twitter accounts, there's all this tremendous potential to really reach out to the world. So I'm excited.
It seems timely as well, because I mean, we're having an explosion of science taking place all the time. We an inundation of discoveries on mm-hmm. many frontiers. So having people to help us understand all these things mean seems to me to be really important.
Absolutely. You know, you want a public that understands science, that recognizes the role it plays in everybody's lives, that values it, and is willing to, you know, support it at, say, a federal level, for example. We've seen recently a lot of cuts to science in Canada, and it's been really unfortunate. And I think if the public really knew the extent to which science is really being decimated here, that folks might say, hey, wait, you know, I want somebody that's representing me in Ottawa that's really going to fight for science, because this is something I believe in. So I really hope that with this new era in science communication, we'll see a lot more informed, engaged citizens.
My guest is Dr. Jennifer Gardy. She is the host of Myth or Science, You Are What You Eat, which the next show, which airs the episode 3, which is tomorrow at 8 p.m. on CBC's Nature Things. We're going to take a quick break. Jen, I'm going to ask you to hold if you could, and we got to pay a couple of bills. It's unfortunate,
sounds
but
good.
That's what we have to do sometimes.
That does not sound good.
I know. And who are you?
I'm the Midas Touch, and I think you need me.
It's that bad?
Not for long. Head to Midas for a comprehensive brake system evaluation, and if needed, we can install brake pads and shoes that come with a lifetime guarantee. How's that sound?
Like sound advice?
Nice one.
Visit Midas at 6 Strathy Road in Cobourg for great customer service from licensed Midas mechanics. For details, give them a call at 905-372-1959.
Trust the Midas Touch.
Head to the Royal Canadian Legion this month to catch these great events.
The League's Auxiliary General Meeting will be held January the 5th at 7:30 p.m. On the 9th and the 23rd, the League's Auxiliary Luncheon starts at 11:30 a.m. and there will be a general meeting on January the 15th at 7:30 p.m.
The Royal Canadian Legion is located at 136 Orr Street in Cobourg. Call 905-372-2231 and become a member today.
The three most visited sites on the web are Google, Facebook, and YouTube. For a business to thrive in such times, they have to make use of as many of these channels as possible. Is your business marketing through these platforms? Matthews Media is now offering a selection of social media marketing packages available for any size of business. We set up, customize, and push your content across all relevant online profiles, driving prospective clients toward your business. To find out more about online and social media marketing, visit our website at matthewsmedia.ca or call 905-375-9520.
I just got married, and I wanted to leave my collection of flannel shirts to my new wife, Lucille, in case of an unfortunate hunting accident. But my cousin Bob was a lousy shot, let me tell you. Jim McGrath made it easy to make a will so that my three previous wives could not touch my stuff. He's been lawyering for 30 years, and let me tell you, he knows what he's doing. Plus, he's a real nice guy. Call Jim McGrath today at 905-373-1999 and tell him Cleta sent you.
And welcome back to Northumberland 89.7. Our guest is Dr. Jennifer Gardy. And Jen, I got to ask you this question. You were talking about science communications.
Yeah.
Bill Nye, the science guy.
He just came to Vancouver and I missed him.
No. So I was going to say, do you know Bill? And are you basically... I mean, are you going to become the Canadian female equivalent to Bill Nye the Science Guy?
Wilhelmina.
Wilhelmina, that's right.
Bill Nye, he's awesome. I remember, you know, growing up in Vancouver, we got a lot of the Seattle television stations.
Right.
And he really got his television start on King 5, the NBC affiliate down there. They had a show that used to run on Saturday nights called Almost Live. And he was kind of their resident science dude, just doing these, you know, crazy, goofy experiments. And I remember sitting there, you know, wrapped in front of the television going, wow, this guy's really super cool. So, you know, he has left a great legacy for science communication here in Canada. David Suzuki, obviously, with the Nature of Things. Jay Ingram, who I count as a good
friend
of mine from Daily Planet, which started out as at discovery.ca. He was hosting Quirks and Quarks CBC before that, which Bob McDonald is now hosting.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Zaya Tong and Dan Riskin, who are hosting Daily Planet right now. There's some really great science communicators out there. So yeah, it's a pleasure to get to move amongst their company.
Well, one of the things you raised just before the break was this idea that scientists in this country, for whatever reason, are just, they're not getting their due. They're being, they're seeing their funding disappearing, or at least drying up to a certain extent. How do you think, you know, citizens can respond to that? I mean, a show like this, quite frankly, you know, while it's entertaining, it's also extremely informative, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, really the best thing is if you feel strongly and passionately about science and feel that our government needs to do more to support it, is get in touch with your MP, get in touch with your MLA at the provincial level, let your voice be heard and say, I want a government that values science. I want a government that isn't going to cut funding to basic or applied research. I want a government that is going to fund science for science's sake, and not, you know, science that's focused on getting a patent or making a product. You know, for example, what we do in public health, it's not a commercializable thing. You know, our research isn't going to lead to, you know, things you can sell and make money off of, but it's going to lead to, you know, say things like 300 fewer people getting tuberculosis in a year, to use, you know, my own work as an example. So there's very real important good things for Canada's economy that can be gained by supporting science that doesn't necessarily have this sort of translational, you know, product endpoint. So I think, yeah, writing to your local MP or MLA, making your voice heard.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you, you know, you've just raised an interesting point, but I want to throw this back at you. What is the economic impact when you lose those 300 people? I mean, if you can utilize, I mean, you may not be selling something that's marketable, but by keeping people alive, you are helping with the tax base. Let's be frank. You know, there are not a lot of dead Canadians out there paying taxes.
They're paying taxes, exactly. And, you know, that's one of the things that's always surprised me a lot as somebody that works in public health. It is so clear to me and to all of my colleagues, and I think anybody that has, you know, half a dose of common sense, that the best way to have a healthy population is to prevent disease from occurring in the first place.
Absolutely,
not to treat it once it happens. Yet, I see this a lot at the provincial government level, you know, in BC, for example, I'm sure it's the case in every other province, is that governments get so focused on saving money and, you know, having a record at the end of, say, their four-year term, being able to say, like, hey, you know, we slashed $100 million from the healthcare budget under our watch.
Exactly.
But they're not around 25 years later when the ripple effect of that initial cut, you know, is finally sort of coming to bear in the population. A great example from British Columbia is that we used to be real leaders in the treatment of mental health. We had some amazing facilities out there, very, very good programs. One of the governments in the 90s started systematically dismantling all of that infrastructure, and you ended up with all of these people that had previously been, you know, attached to care somehow, had somebody looking out for them, were stable, suddenly being, say, released onto the streets.
Yep.
Then you've got, you know, this epidemic of homelessness, for example, and then all of these other attendant disorders and injury and illness that goes along with that. So, you know, if somebody hadn't been slashing budgets, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, a lot of things that we're seeing now wouldn't have happened. So I would love to see governments take more of an interest in what we call primary prevention, investing in things like education, housing, getting people up and moving and eating healthy early in life, being active early in life, setting up those good lifetime habits. That's where we're going to make the best gains in the coming decades.
Well, absolutely. And that's a great point. And you know what? Maybe politicians need to rethink. Maybe instead of saying, you know, we cut the budgets by hundreds of millions of dollars, they can say, you know, by investing in our health infrastructure, we actually saved the lives of 300 people a year. So that's 1,200 more Canadians. You know, I mean, maybe that's the message that should go out. Instead of talking about how much they're saving by not spending money, they can talk about the lives that are saved by spending money.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny, you look back over the years at great political figures, and so many of the people that, you know, remain in our memory and remain as sort of respected Canadians or respected Americans or Brits or Europeans are people that had that foresight to make changes that had long-term positive effects. You know, a great example is Canada. When we have such sort of tight regulation around mortgages and the housing market and the financial industry, these were all things that were put into place years ago that paid out when the U.S. and so many other countries experienced a really severe recession. And Canada was relatively buffered from that because somebody had been prescient enough many years ago to set some important policies. Mm-hmm. So we need to see that happening, but in health.
Absolutely. And you are a public health professional, too. So, I mean, you know, it's very important that we understand that, you know, there are root causes. You know, you mentioned a lot of people being put out on the street when they canceled funding for psychiatric treatment and care. Same thing mm-hmm. happened here in Ontario. I mean, we had a similar to Bill Vanderzamp Socred's in BC. We had Mike Harris, right? And I know you don't want to mention names, but I love mentioning names here and letting people, because, you know, part of the role here for my show is to remind people to be the elephant in the room, right? And elephants never forget. So,
yes.
You know.
Well, I would then tell the listeners that when it comes to science, our current prime minister, I'll name a name, Stephen Harper, is not very kind to science. So, you know, I don't care what people think of his views and other aspects of life, but when it comes to science, which is what I'm qualified to comment on, mm-hmm. you know, this guy has been bad news for Canadian science across the board. Environment Canada, for example, one of the world-leading environmental research organizations. That used mm-hmm. to be so strong, and it was something that Canada could really be proud of. He has literally decimated it. It's, you know, a tenth the size that it used to be, closing down experimental facilities across the country. They even burned a library of Environment Canada resources. Who
exactly.
does that?
Well,
it's barbaric.
Exactly. Who does do that? Rob, you had a question.
Yeah, I did, because we're coming up towards the end of our time, and I'd like to know, for our listeners, what are some of the science stories we should be watching in the upcoming weeks and months to keep an eye on?
One of my favorite ones that just came out today, and this is going to be a really, really interesting one, is, so just to give you a bit of background here, we all, I think, know that antibiotic resistance mm-hmm. is becoming a problem. It's certainly popping up in the headlines. We're hearing about these superbugs and how we can no longer treat infections. There's been some staggering numbers that have just come out in the last little while saying that we're facing a future where 10 million people a year could die because they get an infection that we can no longer treat. We just
right.
don't have effective drugs anymore. So that's a really important story to be following that's going to play out over the next 10 to 20 years. But in the short term, there was a very exciting announcement today of the discovery of a new antibiotic. It's one of the first ones that's been discovered in a really long time. And evidence suggests that it might be harder for bacteria to develop resistance to this new antibiotic than we've seen in the past. So we might have a new weapon in our arsenal against bacterial infections.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's going to be a really important story to watch. And that's something that, again, I'd say everybody needs to be really aware of and really concerned about. I mean, think about a future where we don't have antibiotics. And, you know, say you get a scratch, you're out mm-hmm. gardening, you put your finger on a rose bush or something, and that scratch gets infected. You know, right now, you just slap a little bit of polysporin or something on it, and the, you know, redness and swelling goes down, and boom, mm-hmm. you're fine. But imagine where that could develop into a life-threatening infection.
No,
very
absolutely.
Real possibility, yeah. So I think that's a really interesting one. What else would I follow? I tend to be a bit biased towards public health and infectious disease related things. I think it's really important to keep an eye on some of the climate change stuff that's happening and mm-hmm. not so much, you know, the idea that climate change exists and is real, because we know it is. We have piles and piles of evidence to indicate that it is. But to really start to think about what that means for our future on that planet. How are we going to have to change, you know, our diets, for example, taking it back to Myth or Science 3 and talking about food? Are we facing a different sort of food future? How is that going to play out over the next 10 to 15 years? What about alternative energy sources?
Mm-hmm.
There's some really interesting stuff out there and some very good people that are writing, doing these YouTube videos, publishing about this stuff that are really easy to follow. So even if somebody's not an expert, but they want to really sort of brush up on, say, antimicrobial resistance, it's as easy as going to Google and finding some good resources.
Right.
One of the things I'm also curious about is food security. Could you mm-hmm. comment a bit about that in the future?
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting because, you know, we've got changing climates. certainly. So crops that have grown really well in the past in particular areas may not grow as well. You're also going to see changing land use where, you know, suddenly a region that was known for one thing loses that cash crop and has to turn to something else. You know, you're seeing that right now in parts of California that are going, you know, completely dry. Mm-hmm. And crops that have, you know, paved the way for generations before us have now basically disappeared, and other farms and other industries are moving in. And I think also people are becoming more conscious of our urban food environment and how access to food is such a critical determinant of health. You know, there's these things that people have recognized recently, these food deserts, which is the idea that in a particular region, mm-hmm. you might not have access to a good supermarket or a source of fresh produce. You know,
like
your only place that's
like in Nunavut, for instance.
Exactly, yeah. And that's a huge issue in the north. You know, food is incredibly expensive. And really the only stuff that survives and can stay on the shelf for a long time is this highly processed stuff that, mm-hmm. you know, we're telling people, don't eat this. Yet at the same time, we're not giving them a choice. You know, life and your health is about the choices you make, but it's about the choices that are available
exactly.
to you.
Exactly.
You know, so many people always say, well, they could choose to eat healthier. But yeah, sometimes that choice just isn't available. So I think recognizing that and working to overcome that, that's going to be huge too.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to wrap up then, could you tell us what you're going to be up to in the next little while? What can we expect from you in the near future?
Well, I'll be trucking along doing my usual science stuff, but we're doing two episodes of Myth or Science for next season on the nature of things. In Myth or Science 4, we're going to be looking at weather, and in Myth or Science 5, we're taking a look at the science behind how we sleep at night.
Ah.
So there will be a little more self-experimentation and a lot more science, and yeah, a lot more fun to come.
Well, very good. I want to thank you, Jen. My guest has been Dr. Jennifer Gardy. She is the intrepid scientist who has laid her body on the line in Myth or Science 1 and 2. You can catch episode 3 this week, tomorrow night, as a matter of fact, on CBC's The Nature of Things, Thursday, January 8th at 8 p.m., 8:30 in Newfoundland. Of course, Jen, been wonderful to talk to you. And, you know, we'd love to have you back any time you feel that you want to come on. You would just give us a call here, and we would be more than happy to sit down and chat with you. And maybe
love
not
that.
Necessarily for an hour, but who knows? Maybe if we've got an hour of material, we're gonna you know, draw that out of you.
This girl loves to talk.
Thanks a lot, Jen. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful
Happy
night,
New
everyone.
Year to you, by the way.
Happy New Year too.
Bye bye now.
Bye.
So that was Dr. Jennifer Gardy. She was just a fantastic guest. I want to thank Rob for being here as well. As we come to the top of the hour, folks, it's Dave Glover here on your drive time. You're listening to Northumberland 89.7, truly local radio. Coming up next, Cedar Rail.
Northumberland 89.7 is CFWN, truly local radio, serving Northumberland County, a not-for-profit volunteer community radio station.